For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Artificial intelligence went from science fiction to science fact in the time that it took to say ChatGPT. Seemingly, in a year's time, the world has become one in which AI is either the answer to all of our problems or the problem that will result in the loss of jobs or even the beginning of the end of all humanity. The divergent expectations are the reason we need a true expert to help us sort things out. Luckily, we have one with us today, right here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Ed Wattal, and he is the founder and the principal of Intellibus. It's an IT strategy consultancy, 65 transformation consultants based in Reston, Virginia. And you've got a lot of other credits, but I want to just thank you for being with us today here on America Trends and want to know more about artificial intelligence and the coming economic revolution, perhaps, that artificial intelligence will yield on our behalf. I guess the question is, number one, what is artificial intelligence if we're to do a primer? And why is it perhaps not as scary as a lot of people say it is?
Oh, well, thank you, first off, for having me, and I appreciate the kind introduction. So I get this question asked all the time, and I briefly talked this fall, artificial intelligence at the New York University, and you know, depending on the audience, you know, there's always a slightly different definition, and often people have the Skynet definition in their minds of, you know, when they think about AI, and you know, most of us watch movies. But I think there's a simplistic way to think about artificial intelligence, which is it's a tool. You know, humans have always fashioned tools, right, from the Stone Age to, you know, software and computers that we built and the phones that we use and the smartphones or, you know, driverless cars that are coming. And artificial intelligence is no different than simply being a tool that we've invented. However, the twist here or the slight difference from all the other tools that we've invented in the past is this tool is becoming more and more what is called anamorphic, human-like. And historically, if you see some of the greatest designers like Charles Eames, who created the famous lounge chair that sits in the Metropolitan Museum, and several other creators, the greatest creators are creators who built anamorphic products that are in the man's own image. And so when you start to create something in a man's own image or the human's own image, at some point you end up creating the human itself, which is, of course, you know, closer to the Skynet and the Frankenstein concerns that people have. And that's kind of where a lot of that, I think, comes from. But very simplistically, artificial intelligence is a tool. And yes, we're casting it more and more in our image. So it begins to feel scary because, you know, sometimes it feels scary to look at your own face in the mirror.
Let me ask you, is it something that can grow to be more intelligent than us? It's better at certain things, and certain simple tasks can be done through AI that would take us a long time to do. So we want to offload those to artificial intelligence. But could it go beyond our own imaginings, as we have seen in science fiction?
So that's a question I get asked again quite often, where people sort of say, and people talk about AGI, artificial general intelligence. So I think the three terms that we can think about, and which some of us may have already heard of, is ANI, AGI, and ASI. ANI is artificial narrow intelligence, which is the idea of traditional artificial intelligence, you know, where you have, you know, basic supervised and unsupervised learning or regression models. And then there's more advancements in that, in neural networks and so forth. And now we're reaching closer and closer to what people call artificial general intelligence, as in an AI that can answer any question. Very similar to GPT, of course, GPT still is not AGI. An AGI would be closer to what you would think of as Jarvis in the movie Iron Man. And then comes the next order, which is what some people called ASI, artificial superintelligence, which is an AI that is beyond our human comprehension. So even to think what that AI may be like, what the agenda of such an AI may be, and what it might do is probably beyond human comprehension, at least at this point. And people have, you know, talked about various topics like singularity and so forth. But I think realistically, are we anywhere close to AGI? Some people would say you're 5-10 years out. And is ASI ever going to happen? It's anybody's best guess.
Well, if we're only 5 or 10 years out, do you think we really need to have some standards, some guidelines, some guardrails in relation to this? I know that my U.S. Senator, Richard Blumenthal, is a part of the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law, and he is suggesting that we need to get a hold of this. Now, I know that Congress has been looking at the potential of AI. They think they got a bit behind as it relates to computers and social media. Are they in any way going to be able to address the issues surrounding AI as you see them in the next 5 to 10 years, what they may become?
So first off, thanks for sharing, you know, what Senator Richard Blumenthal is trying to do. And it's very encouraging when you see, you know, folks, you know, who are there, you know, in the right, I would say, power centers or areas where they have influence, who are willing to ask the right questions. And not always we have the answers. So it's encouraging that people are asking the right questions. Even if you look at the executive order from President Biden that came out a few days, a weeks ago, didn't really give any answers. It was still provoking the right questions and is asking people to do the right things. And it was basically putting the onus and burden on various agencies and organizations to go find the answers and giving them a deadline and then putting some sort of guardrails. But I think the guardrails that are being put are still fairly broad and generic. And until the organizations come together and come up with very specific guardrails, it's going to be tricky. And case in point is a very recent thing that happened. I'm assuming a lot of the listeners, you know, of your podcast probably know that there's something called Common Crawl. It's the crawl data from the internet. That is what is used. It's one of the various data sets that is used for training things like GPT. What New York Times did is they didn't want their data to be used because they felt that it was not being used necessarily in the best light and advantages to them, to their business model. Because imagine if everybody is just searching New York Times data within GPT, they're probably never going to visit the New York Times website. And that would be the end of the New York Times business, you know, proverbially over a period of time. And so, therefore, if New York Times went and worked with the authorities that be and with the Common Crawl Foundation to get their data removed, I recently made a post on LinkedIn about this and I encourage people to take a look at it. If you see what the consequence of that is, that now you could argue that, okay, that's great from New York Times perspective. It protects their business model. It's probably, some purists would argue, that it is the ethical and responsible thing to do, because now that data is not being used without copyright permissions from New York Times. But the flip side of it is that there's no way to untrain, at least known way right now, meaningfully untrain or unlearn the training that was done to the existing GPT models. So now, and there's no ban that has been put on the existing GPT models, not that I'm suggesting it should be. But as a consequence now, OpenAI is the only company that has a trained model, or a handful of companies like OpenAI have a trained model with the New York Times data. And unless New York Times now goes and asks for some other mechanism for these models to not be used, you've created a very unfair advantage in the industry. So the companies who previously had the previous data, you know, they have an unfair advantage. I mean, one could argue that. I mean, whether the advantage is unfair or not is only a function of, you know, how the efficacy of future models that are used without and built without the New York Times data.
Let's talk about the things that we worry about most as it relates to AI and the things that we perhaps don't look at as wonderful aspirational possibilities with AI. Job displacement and job creation. Which is going to have the winning strategy as it relates to AI as you see it? And in what areas would you be most concerned that AI, we are told it's white collar, might replace you?
I appreciate you bringing that question up because very recently Fox Business asked me for comments about a couple of weeks ago on this topic, and their concern was more around blue collar jobs. So there's a Fox article that you could find at Fox Business that talks about, you know, that AI threatens blue-collar jobs as well. Mm. If you look at research that's out there, and I'll give an example that'd be easier to relate. Like, we've all been in an elevator, right? And for those of us who are old enough, we've been in an elevator that had an elevator person, or elevator boy, as you would call it. And now we don't see that anymore. In fact, there was a time when elevators had buttons. A lot of them still do. There's time these days, we go to a very modern building in Manhattan, there are no buttons in the elevator either. So we are going towards a world where it's getting heavily automated. If you were to think of, you know, the elevator boy was replaced, buttons are still there, you could punch it. Now the elevator is intelligent enough, it just takes you where you need to go. If you take that a little further, you think of warehouses. Historically, in warehouses, you had humans moving things around. Now almost all major warehouses, which are heavily automated, like Amazon's, you know, bins and shelves move to the person who's binning. You don't have to walk, go around in the warehouse picking stuff up like you would do in a Costco. So unlike humans going in Costco from door to door, from bin to bin and putting stuff in their cart, that doesn't happen in Amazon for the most part. In Amazon or any of these automated warehouses, these machines bring the bins to the person who's binning, and they just stand there. So imagine if you went to Costco and all you had to do is stand there in one place at the front door of Costco or by the line with your cart, and all the boxes just came to you and you could pick and choose what you want. Right? Mm-hmm. So that's already happening. And Costco probably makes most no sense for them to automate this because, hey, you'll still buy. You're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Right? But when it comes to Amazon, they've got to ship millions of packages. It's just not efficient for them to do that. So they've come up with these efficiency models. So now some of the jobs have gone away. Supervisory jobs have also gone away because now if these machines are moving things around, the supervision can be just done by a machine. So what is still remaining? A person who's going to take stuff out of a bin and put it in a cardboard box and gets shipped to your home. That's kind of the main job remaining. And again, I'm oversimplifying this. There are still drivers that drive in the Amazon Prime trucks and bring things to you. So in essence, the blue-collar jobs are impacted just as well as the white-collar. And I think white-collar jobs is, needless to say, I'm sure we all use GPT and we all know the threat that's out there.
Well, the New York Times, I thought I read recently, because you raised them earlier, that some of their reporting was going to become AI-generated. So there are newspapers and different sources of information where they are offloading that. Is the material now collected and is utilized by these supercomputers, I guess, is it accurate enough? Because we know that young people and other older learners are using it in the classrooms, and I'm really wondering what you think about that trend, because how can a teacher really determine, other than perhaps a student going in and kind of mucking up their work a little bit to make it look less perfect, how do they know that it's being generated by the person or the machine?
So it's interesting you think of the power of AI. The power of AI is kind of now available to both people, right? The person who wants to cheat and the person who wants to catch the person cheating. Mm-hmm. And so it's now become this sort of tussle on both sides. People will build tools. And so on the one side, people will build a plagiarism remover or plagiarism fixer. So you can, you know, generally plagiarize if you wanted to, and it will fix the fact nobody will find out that you plagiarized, right? And on the other side, you know, there will be someone which will be a leak checker, which will check the fact that, you know, you're leaking data or, you know, plagiarizing data. So, and our organizations should care about this, because imagine, you know, historically you would just block different websites when, you know, you didn't want your organization data to leak. Most organizations today don't want to block, you know, other than of course Apple and some other companies that I believe have blocked OpenAI, so ChatGPT, so people in their workplace can just go paste company data into GPT. But at the same time, you know, Microsoft's working with creating enterprise versions of it, so people can use it. So I think the same goes, you know, with the students. You know, on the one side, the teachers can use it, then there are people who are building tools to you know, catch that. And on the flip side, people are building tools that you can't catch that. I think then there's a broader question of, you know, should that be allowed? And if it is allowed, what does it mean, right? And you'll see a lot of debate online where people say, it's perfectly okay. It's just that the way we used to train and learn is changing. And so the analogy that I like to give is, you know, how should you think about learning in the future? So there's this, you know, Jewish concept. You know, I'm not Jewish and I'm not trying to favor any religion. There's this Jewish concept called Havrut, which is paired study. So I believe the real value here between the man and the machine here is elevating the man and machine relationship to the next level, so man and machine can exist symbiotically, learning from each other. And so the real value of the future of AI, in the future of AI, would be not to say, oh, don't use it at the workplace. We have to shift our mental model. You'd ask people about education. Most people would tell you, oh, the education system kind of sucks. I hate to pay for all this college fees for my kids. I don't know if I'm getting the worthwhile value, because after they're done with all this $200,000 they spend on their education, they still can't find a job. So we have all that complexity still out there. And so if we were to allow AI, and leaving the ethical and data and privacy questions aside, because that needs to still be addressed, and assuming we can somehow address it, the value of being in Havrut, the man-machine relationship, and man learning from the machine, vice versa, is kind of where the future is headed.
Ed Wattal, the founder and principal of Intellibus, is with us to help us walk through this whole area of AI. What do you think has been discussed in the popular press, and what do you think really we're missing that nobody's really focused on that may be as important as the issues that we've discussed here to date on this podcast and in other conversations you've had in the media?
I think the concept of truth is what is sort of at the very root of this. So one of the biggest concerns people had with the initial AI, which is much before ChatGPT came out, maybe when, you know, President Trump was trying to run for elections, was the idea of deepfakes. And we know there were deepfakes on the internet. So deepfakes suddenly became a significant problem, you know, because people would create deepfakes of people, which now people can't tell what's true and what's not true anymore.
Just to make certain we all understand, so you could modify images and text in such a way that we don't know what's real and what's not.
Yeah, a deepfake, just for those you know, who may be wondering what a deepfake is. Deepfake is essentially you could create a video of you know, say a celebrity saying something that they never said, or you know, wearing certain clothes that they never wore. So that's a deepfake. You know, you're sort of creating a fake. It doesn't exist, but it feels real. When you look at it, you'll be like, oh, it's that same person. So you can't tell whether it's that person or it's... So, yeah. So the piece that sort of opened and most people are not talking about is this concept and idea of truth. And truth is relative in some sense, because we've all heard of that example of, you know, six blindfolded people trying to look at an elephant. And they all come up with their own views of what they think it is. No one can see the whole elephant because they're all blindfolded. So that's kind of how it is on the internet. The information is so fragmented, it's so distributed, it's all over the place, and of course it's often doctored because people will put their bias and their perspectives in it. Now, bias in itself is not a bad thing, it's just your perspective, or it could be, when the bias, and there's 365 different types of biases. And so the internet is filled with myriad of these biases in various quantities. From ethical to racial to, you know, philosophical and so forth, and just basic cognitive biases when people look at that information. The hard part here is when you take that data on the internet, and some people would argue that 80% of the data on the internet is duplicative or unclean or not true. And if that is the case, then that's the data we have fed tools like GPT. Now they sound very human-like. Now that's very troublesome.
What is it that AI is doing today in our everyday lives that we don't even see the fact that this invisible hand is there guiding this process?
if you were to think about where AI has already been in use, and I'm not talking about artificial general intelligence, which is fairly new. It's been there for about a year, really out there in the mainstream world. The artificial intelligence per se has been used in the financial industry for over a decade. If you ever use, for example, a service like PayPal to send a payment internationally, there is an artificial intelligence-based algorithm that sits at the back and tries to determine whether what you're doing is a fraud or money laundering or not, and it kicks out your payment. So sometimes your payment doesn't go through and you get an email. And so AI is sort of sitting there in such a decision-making position. So wherever it is hard and complex to make decisions based on lots and lots of parameters, you know, people would resort to using artificial intelligence because otherwise it's expensive to have a lot of humans looking at all this coming in, and especially the volume of transactions when it is extremely high. For example, people think of a simple example of Facebook. If people start to upload, pornographic pictures or, you know, malicious content on Facebook, how many people should sit there behind the Facebook firewall to see whether there's bad content and remove it, or, you know, wait for a human to come and report the issue? Then the entire Facebook will be pretty unclean and dirty. So you need something like artificial intelligence that can read, kind of digitally read the image or video that you uploaded, or read the comment and then act on it intelligently. And we've seen, I mean, Twitter and lots of other organizations kind of have these kind of tools, and they've existed for a while. It's just the ability for AI to then generate content based on all its knowledge is something that's fairly recent and new.
Now, I know that you feel that there is a potential for exponential economic growth if we use AI effectively. There are some studies, of course, as you know, that suggest that as many as half of the U.S. jobs are vulnerable to automation in the near future. And yet there are others who say that work is not a zero-sum game. A person who is aided by a team of robots may be much more productive and hence much more in demand. How do we look at this for an economy going forward? And believe me, I understand that we have an economy even today that if I ask my young people, my children, what they do in their jobs, it's totally different than anything most of us would have been thinking about or doing or job types 40 years ago. So I don't want to be, you know, at all a Neanderthal as it relates to this. So tell me, on balance, where are we headed as it relates to our own productivity and our own role in society when AI is even more sophisticated than it is today?
I think in the near future, we'll just see a couple of very easy to understand trends, more automation. For example, the number of driverless cars will increase. And that's a pretty safe assumption to make. The fact that almost all the cars today have some sort of lane assist, but then again, regulation still allows you to hold the steering wheel. At some point, the cars will become safe enough that regulation will go away. And so then you can truly have a driverless car where you could be sleeping and you're fine. And we haven't reached there. Will it take 5 years or 10 or 20? No one knows. But that's the vector we can see very clearly. That's where it's headed. And you think about it, there are trains in smaller cities and locations which are automated completely, which don't have a person driving the train because it runs on a track. Or in cars, it's a little more complicated. And so that problem will get solved. So that's driver jobs for example, people who are in the job of driving taxis and cars and cabs, they will definitely be impacted in the short term. Then comes the broader question, okay, what's next beyond that? Of course, a lot of knowledge work and research that's happening is going to go away because today you would have to hire an agency to create a graphic or create an image. Now it can happen faster. So some of it is going to be just compression. Things will happen faster, maybe cheaper. Not necessarily eliminate jobs, but the same person will be able to do more. Companies will get more efficient and productive. But I think the question is how soon and how quick? And then what's sort of the ultimate future in all this? And not talking about AGI and far in the future, but fairly recent, maybe fairly close, maybe in the next 5 to 20 years, if not more, depending on how quickly companies innovate. You could potentially reach a point where there's this central AI engine of the world, and you could argue in some sense that ChatGPT has become a central AI engine of the world with 100 million people connected to it. So you could perceive that there would be a central AI engine of the world with all 8 billion people connected to it. or there could be multiple such engines with all the people connected. It's kind of like how you have multiple social media systems. Does that mean that all the jobs have gone away? No, just people are plugged into these engines, and then these engines elevate our potential. So you're able to do a lot more, achieve a lot more within your lifetime, and other jobs will emerge as a consequence of that, which are not there. Humans will do jobs which are higher order thinking, which is not possible today. It'll accelerate learning. It'll create a more level playing field. Earlier, you know, people didn't have access. Even now, about 2 billion people on the earth don't even have access to the internet. The rate at which we solve problems and diseases, think of earlier how long it used to find a vaccine cure, decades. When COVID was there, we found a vaccine in 1 to 2 years. It's because technologies like artificial intelligence exist.
Well, you are an expert also on cloud basics. And when I think about the cloud, help me understand where AI fits in. The cloud itself allows people from all over the world to interact with the same content and material and move a process along much more quickly. I mean, the cloud itself has done so much to change the speed and the impact of computing. So put AI on top of the cloud, which your expertise is really unique in allowing us to do, and tell us what that means.
AI, one could argue, is, if you look at tools like GPT, one could argue it's running in the cloud as far as you, a user, are concerned, because just like you use service running in the cloud, like a Google Drive or a Gmail or a Dropbox, you just go to a browser URL, you type, and you don't know where the servers are, and that's impervious to you. So in some sense, as an end user, when you consume things on a browser, you don't know where the data is actually being stored. It could be anywhere. You just sort of assume it's in the cloud. And without getting into details of how cloud technologies like Azure, AWS, or Amazon Web Services, or Google Cloud work, we just kind of have expected to believe that these services exist and then they work. Most of the providers like Azure, which is Microsoft, and Amazon Web Services, and Google, they're enabling organizations, other businesses, to come and either leverage tools like GPT on their cloud or build GPT-like products using, for example, Facebook has a model called Llama. You can use Llama within an Amazon service called AWS Bedrock. So cloud is sort of becoming an enabler for organizations to leverage the AI technologies. It's just becoming a place like a server or a space for you to store your data for AI, to run your computational processes for AI. Now, that's definitely helpful, but cloud also is connected to the edge. Edge meaning the phone or the devices that you use, you know, your car, your phone, your home, you know, devices in your home like the Apple TV and so forth. Eventually, at some point, those AI algorithms also start to run, and some of them already do, because that's how face recognition works on your phone, go to the edge. And so it's cloud, in some sense, is a place where you run the compute, but it's also a place from you distribute all the AI models all over to the edge.
If I go back to 2014, the media started regularly reporting on concerns that were voiced by people like Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk, Steve Wozniak, and Bill Gates. And they thought that, you know, we were kind of doomed by this existential risk from AI. Now, not all of them are still around, but most of them are. Are you hearing those thinkers and visionaries change their mind as we see what's really developed over the last 10 years?
People change their mind over time. So if you and people sometimes just try to be as honest as possible. Now, if you look at Sam Altman, right, he's being as honest as possible because he's saying on the one side that, oh, artificial intelligence has this great potential. We would all agree. We've seen what the capabilities are now of ChatGPT. But at the same time, he's also talking about the existential risk and saying, yes, potentially this could be terrible for all of us. So now when someone who's a responsible leader like him says that, it sort of lends more credence to all the people before him who came along and he talked about existential risk. And at the same time, it sort of takes away a little bit from people who really want to accelerate and progress. Because, yes, if you create capability to harness nuclear energy, it can be turned into a bomb or it can be converted into a nuclear power plant. So the same holds true here with artificial intelligence. Right? You could use it to do something very terrible, or you could use it very responsibly. So it's never about the knife or the tool that was created. It's really about how humans choose to use it responsibly.
No, I just did a podcast on the coming of the AR-15 back in the 1950s and 60s, and I don't think the founder of that, Eugene Stoner, would ever have imagined that we'd be using it in a civilian context. And he built it for a fight against communism. Let me just ask you this. Of all the things that you've seen in the last year of commercial application through ChatGPT, what excites you the most, and what has not held the promise that you might have thought over the last year? I know that's a short period of time, but is there anything you'd comment on about its application thus far?
What excites me the most is how it shortens the learning cycle for a human. So let's take an example so we can understand this better. Historically, when you didn't know anything about a topic, it was very hard to get a good answer out of Google because you didn't even know what keywords to search for. And that was a problem. And therefore, we needed a mentor, a coach, a guide, someone who would go and tell us, oh, what should you do? Or you went and picked a book. And that book had an index and it had a whole bunch of keywords. You would go read that and you'd be like, oh, or you picked a dictionary in that field, medicine or law or whatever you were trying to learn, or banking and finance. So historically, you resorted to, despite the internet, despite all the knowledge out there, you were limited in the sense and speed at which you could learn. And you would have to do lots of searches and queries to get a basic mind map of the topic you're trying to learn. Now, of course, ChatGPT doesn't spit a mind map out for you. It's not a mind mapping tool. But we have, you know, as I was teaching at New York University, leveraged GPT surely to enhance our own understanding around artificial intelligence using tools like GPT to build the AI mind map. And that has really helped, because often you may not get all the aspects and perspectives by doing a Google search. So when you go to GPT, you can give it a bunch of keywords and you can say, hey, tell me what are all the related words. Now, Google does show you related words, but it's not the same as GPT, because GPT, you could incessantly keep asking it 100 times to give you more and more related words. So now you can very rapidly and vastly expand your knowledge through this. So this has been the most promising thing that I've seen, and it's helped us a little bit in developing our AI mind map. And of course, we had to, you know, still read the books and do our own research and apply our own thinking around it. So that's been the promising part. What's been the not so promising part, which again is an area of improvement, I should say. It's been fairly interesting, but it's still a significant area of improvement, is the multimodal AI capabilities of these models. So what does that mean? What is multimodal capability? So, and again, the word multimodal can mean different things in different domains and business contexts. But here specifically, when I say multimodal, what I'm referring to is your ability to put any type of content into the AI as an input, or expect any type of content out of the AI as an output. For example, can I give an AI just a text blob, which is chat? Now, can I upload an image in the chat? Can I upload a video? Can I just put a voice note in a chat, like how you'd send a voice note on a communication tool like WhatsApp? So what are the different modes of data that I can feed in? And the AI is able to take the different modes of data and understand and process them. So I can ask it a question saying, I upload a picture of a shoe, and I say, hey, what kind of a shoe is this, or what color is this shoe? To take a simple example. And vice versa. Can it produce outputs? So now we know tools like DALL-E and Midjourney produce videos and produce images. And then similarly, there are other tools that can generate videos and so forth. So that's the space where I feel there is still, of course, they're pretty good, but there's still a lot of improvement possible. And I have certain examples and case studies which I'm going to potentially blog about at some point, which show the sort of complexity. And some will argue that it's a prompt, what is called the prompt engineering problem, as in, you know, the answer is only as good as the question you ask. So maybe I'm not asking the right questions to GPT, and maybe if I just ask the right question, and therefore people say, oh, prompt engineering jobs are going to be the most important jobs, because it's really, you know, whoever can search the right answer, you know, takes the cake.
Garbage in, garbage out is still applicable, I guess. Let me ask you, progress over the next few decades. We deal in trends here on this podcast, as you know. So the question is, when you think about speech recognition or information extraction from simple factual material, as we were discussing, robotic manipulation of everyday products, the way the medical community can more quickly diagnose, or, you know, any of the other things, autonomous driving. What do you think we're going to see in the next period, which will have the greatest effect, do you think, positively on our lives?
I think accelerating human learning and giving humans the ability to very rapidly understand concepts is definitely one area, and part of, maybe I'm biased a little bit here because I teach at NYU and I'm, you know, very close to the education sector, so that comes to mind. And even as Intellibus Consulting and Advisory, a lot of what we do is educating C-level executives and board members, so and engineers. So I think education seems to me, from where I sit, my vantage point, the most obvious one. Aside from that, I definitely see its impact in commerce, how commerce happens today. I won't talk much about it because there are things we're working on that we're keeping a little bit under the wraps on how commerce itself may transform. It will be unveiled pretty shortly in the next couple of months, where how commerce can be significantly impacted. And I think there are various categories where we will see transformation, like the entire publishing industry. And as you can see at the forefront, New York Times, whatever's happening with entertainment, with script writing. So we're going to see a lot of change in those areas, and how content is generated, how content is processed, how books are written, for example. So we're going to see a lot of that change. And commerce in itself, the whole industry, the way it works, the way the value chain works, is going to change drastically.
Interesting. Well, I look forward to being around to see all that. And we saw where the stage, the screen actors, and that was a big part of their deliberations over 4 months to get to a point where will this have an impact on their industry. So it's all so fascinating. And you are so expert in all of this. It was such an honor to have you on with us today. Ed Wattal, the founder and principal of Intellibus. If anybody wants to read the things that you're constantly putting out so that we are up to date, how would we do that?
I think following me on LinkedIn, that's probably the easiest thing. You can search for me, Ed Wattal, on LinkedIn. That's where, and I don't post much off late. I'm starting to do that. So I think that's one place, easy one to go. I am also contemplating to launch a podcast, which I will be doing pretty soon. Podcast/blog. I'd probably be more a blog than a podcast, but that's something that's gonna come out. If you go to the Intellibus YouTube, that's another place you could find a lot of content, which, you know, I talk about. Most of whatever I have to say would certainly be available on the Intellibus YouTube. All you have to do is search on YouTube for Intellibus. And aside from that, on our website, we have an insights page, where not only can you find our thoughts, but what we're also doing is we're curating all the useful content on the internet. So that's, if you just simply went to our website, that's www.intellibus.com/insights. I can check if it's not. Yes, slash insights. And there you'd see all the thought leadership. It's essentially whatever research we're publishing out, our ideas, but also we are curating all the good work that's being done by others. So it's easily, kind of think of it like an index of the internet. So you can easily search there, you know, what is happening in responsible AI and so forth, and what's the latest research. So that's another resource to go and look at, beyond not just what we're doing, but the whole world is doing, at intellibus.com/insights.
Well, that's great. I thank you so much for being with us. Again, really important topic. Thanks for being here on America Trends.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.